You cannot increase your own fortune in this way. There is a very ancient occult law which stops one from profiting from prayers for self-gain. You cannot do it for yourself unless it is to help others, and unless you sincerely believe that it will help others. I know of an actual case wherein a man who had a moderate income and was fairly comfortably off, thought that if he won the Irish sweepstake he would help others, he would be a great benefactor of mankind. Knowing a little, but not enough, of esoteric matters, he made great plans of what he would do. He set out with a carefully prepared program of prayers. He prayed along the lines set out in this chapter for 2 months. He prayed that he would pick the winner of the Irish sweepstake. For 2 months he prayed in groups of 3 prayers, 3 times a day, 9 prayers in all during the day. As he fully anticipated, he won the Irish sweepstake, and he won one of the biggest prizes of them all. Eventually he had the money and it went to his head. He forgot all about his good intentions, all about his promises. He forgot all about everything except that he had this vast sum of money and he could now do exactly as he wanted to do. He devoted the money to his own self-gratification. For a very few months he had a wonderful time, during which he became harder and harder, and then the inexorable law came into force, and instead of keeping that money and helping others, he lost everything that he had gained, and everything that he had before. In the end he died and was buried in a pauper's grave. I say to you that if you use the power of prayer properly, without thought of self-gain, without thought of self-aggrandizement, then you have tapped one of the greatest powers on earth, a force so great that if just a few genuine people got together and prayed for peace, then there would be peace, and wars and thoughts of wars would be no more. For some time after there was silence as they digested what I had told them, then the woman said, "I wish you would stay here a while and teach us. We have seen a miracle, but someone came and told us not to talk about it." I rested for a few hours, then dressed and wrote a letter to my official friends in Shanghai, telling them what had happened to my papers. By airmail they sent me a fresh passport which certainly eased my position. By airmail there arrived a letter from a very rich woman. For some time, she wrote, "I have been trying to find your address. My daughter, whom you saved from the Japanese, is now with me and is completely restored to health. You saved her from rape and worse, and I want to repay, at least in part, our debt to you. Tell me what I can do for you." I wrote to her and told her that I wanted to go home to Tibet to die. "I have enough money to buy a ticket to a port in India," I replied, "but not enough to cross that continent. If you really want to help me, buy me a ticket from Bombay to Kalimpong in India." I treated it as a joke, but 2 weeks later I received a letter and first-class sea ticket and first-class rail tickets all the way to Kalimpong. Immediately I wrote to her and expressed my gratitude, telling her that I intended giving my other money to the Negro family who had so befriended me. The Negro family were sad that I was going to leave, but overjoyed that for once in my life I was going to have a comfortable journey. It was so difficult to get them to accept money. In the end we shared it between us. "There is one thing," said the friendly Negro woman. "You knew this money would come as it was for a good purpose. Did you send what you called a thought form for it?" "No," I answered, "it must have been accomplished by a source far removed from this world." She looked puzzled. "You said that you would tell us about thought forms before you left. Will you have time now?" "Yes," I replied. "Sit down, and I will tell you a story." She sat and folded her hands. Her husband turned out the light and sat back in his chair as I began to speak. By the burning sands, amid the grey-stone buildings with the glaring sun overhead, the small group of men wended their way through the narrow streets. After a few minutes they stopped at a shabby-looking doorway, knocked and entered. A few muttered sentences were uttered, and then the men were handed torches which spluttered and sent drops of resin around. Slowly they made their way through corridors, getting lower and lower into the sands of Egypt. The atmosphere was cloying, sickly. It seeped into the nostrils, nauseating by the manner in which it clung to the mucous membrane. There was hardly a glimmer of light here except that which came from the torchbearers who moved along at the head of the small procession. As they went further into the underground chamber the smell became stronger, the smell of frankincense, of myrrh, and of strange exotic herbs from the Orient. There was also the odor of death, of decay, and of decaying vegetation. Against the far wall was a collection of canopic jars containing the hearts and entrails of the people who were being embalmed. They were carefully labeled with the exact contents and with the date of sealing. These the procession passed with hardly a shudder, and went on past the baths of nitre in which bodies were immersed for 90 days. Even now bodies were floating in these baths, and every so often an attendant would come along and push the body under with a long pole and turn it over. With scarcely a glance at these floating bodies, the procession went on into the inner chamber. There, resting upon planks of sweet-smelling wood, was the body of the dead pharaoh, wrapped tightly with linen bandages, powdered well with sweet-smelling herbs, and anointed with unguents. The men entered, and four bearers took the body and turned it about, and put it in a light wooden shell which had been standing against a wall. Then, raising it to shoulder height, they turned and followed the torchbearers out of the underground room, past the baths of nitre, out of the rooms of the embalmers of Egypt. Nearer the surface the body was taken to another room where dim daylight filtered in. Here it was taken out of the crude wooden shell and placed in another one the exact shape of the body. The hands were placed across the breast and tightly bound with bandages. A papyrus was tied to them giving the history of the dead man. Here, days later, the priests of Osiris, of Isis, and of Horus came. Here they chanted their preliminary prayers conducting the soul through the underworld. Here, too, the sorcerers and the magicians of old Egypt prepared their thought forms which would guard the body of the dead man and prevent vandals from breaking into the tomb and disturbing his peace. Throughout the land of Egypt were proclamations of the penalties which would befall any who violated the tomb. The sentence: first the dung of the violator would be torn out, and then his hands would be severed at the wrists. A few days later he would be disemboweled, and buried to the neck in the hot sand where he would live out the few short hours of life. The tomb of Tutankhamun made history because of a curse which fell upon those who violated that tomb. All the people who entered the tomb of Tutankhamun died or suffered mysterious, incurable illnesses. The priests of Egypt had a science which had been lost to the present-day world, the science of creating thought forms to do tasks which are beyond the skill of the human body. But that science need not have been lost, because anyone with a little practice, with a little perseverance, can make a thought form which will act for good or for bad. Who was the poet who wrote, "I am the captain of my soul"? That man uttered a great truth, perhaps greater than he knew, for man is indeed the captain of his soul. Western people have contemplated material things, mechanical things, anything to do with the mundane world. They have tried to explore space, but they have failed to explore the deepest mystery of all, the subconsciousness of man, for man is 9/10 subconscious, which means that only 1/10 of man is conscious. Only 1/10 of man's potential is subject to his volitional commands. If a man can be 1 1/2 tenths conscious, then that man is a genius, but geniuses upon earth are geniuses in one direction only. Often they are very deficient in other lines. The Egyptians in the days of the pharaohs well knew the power of the subconscious. They buried their pharaohs in deep tombs, and with their arts, with their knowledge of humanity, they made spells. They made thought forms which guarded the tombs of the dead pharaohs and prevented intruders from entering, under penalty of dire disease. But you can make thought forms which will do good, but make sure they are for good, because a thought form cannot tell good from evil. It will do either, but the evil thought form in the end will wreak vengeance on its creator. The story of Aladdin is actually the story of a thought form which was conjured up. It is based upon one of the old Chinese legends. Legends which are literally true. Imagination is the greatest force upon earth. Imagination, unfortunately, is badly named. If one uses the word imagination, one automatically thinks of a frustrated person given to neurotic tendencies, and yet nothing could be further from the truth. All great artists, all great painters, great writers too, have to have a brilliant, controlled imagination. Otherwise they could not visualize the finished thing that they are attempting to create. If we in everyday life would harness imagination, then we could achieve what we now regard as miracles. We may, For example, have a loved one who is suffering from some illness for which as yet medical science has no cure. That person can be cured if one makes a thought form which will get in touch with the overself of the sick person, and help that overself to materialize to create new parts. Thus, a person who is suffering from a diabetic condition could, with proper help, recreate the damaged parts of the pancreas which caused the disease. How can we create a thought form? Well, it is easy. We will go into that now. One must first decide what one wants to accomplish, and be sure that it is for good. Then one must call the imagination into play. One must visualize exactly the result which one wants to achieve. Supposing a person is ill with an organ invaded by disease. If we are going to make a thought form which will help, we must exactly visualize that person standing before us. We must try to visualize the afflicted organ. Having the afflicted organ pictorially before us, we must visualize it gradually healing, and we must impart a positive affirmation. So, we make this thought form by visualizing the person. We imagine the thought form standing beside the afflicted person and with supernormal powers reaching inside the body of that sick person, and with a healing touch causing the disease to disappear. At all times we must speak to the thought form which we have created in a firm, positive voice. There must not at any time be any suspicion of negativeness, nor of indecision. We must speak in the simplest possible language and in the most direct manner possible. We must speak to it as we would speak to a very backward child, because this thought form has no reason and can accept only a direct command or a simple statement. There may be a sore on some organ, and we must say to that thought form, "You will now heal such and such an organ. The tissue is knitting together." You would have to repeat that several times daily, and if you visualize your thought form actually going to work, then it will indeed go to work. It worked with the Egyptians, and it can work with present-day people. There are many authenticated instances of tombs being haunted by a shadowy figure. That is because either the dead persons, or others, have thought so hard that they have actually made a figure of ectoplasm. The Egyptians in the days of the pharaohs buried the embalmed body of the pharaoh. But they adopted extreme measures so that their thought forms would be vivified even after thousands of years. They slew slaves slowly, painfully, telling the slaves that they would get relief from pain in the afterworld if in dying they provided the necessary substance with which to make a substantial thought form. Archaeological records have long substantiated hauntings and curses in tombs, and all these things are merely the outcome of absolutely natural, absolutely normal laws. Thought forms can be made by anyone at all with just a little practice, but you must first at all times concentrate upon good in your thought forms, because if you try to make an evil form, then assuredly the thought form will turn upon you and cause you the gravest harm, perhaps in the physical, in the mental, or in the astral state. The next few days were frantic ones: transit visas to obtain, final preparations to be made, and things to be packed up and sent back to friends in Shanghai. My crystal was carefully packed and returned there for my future use, as were my Chinese papers, papers which, incidentally, quite a number of responsible people have now seen. My personal possessions I kept to the absolute minimum, consisting of one suit of clothing and the necessary change of underwear. Now trusting no officials, I had photographic copies made of everything: passport, tickets, medical certificates and all. "Are you coming to see me off?" I asked my Negro friends. "No," they replied. "We should not be allowed near because of the color bar." The final day arrived, and I went by bus to the docks. Carrying my small case, and presenting my ticket, I was confronted with a demand as to the whereabouts of the rest of my luggage. "This is all," I replied. "I am taking nothing more." The official was plainly puzzled and suspicious. "Wait here," he muttered, and hurried off to an inner office. Several minutes later he came out accompanied by a more senior official. "Is this all your luggage, sir?" the new man asked. "It is," I replied. He frowned, looked at my tickets, checked the details against entries in a book, and then stalked off with my tickets and the book. 10 minutes later he came back looking very disturbed. Handing me my tickets and some other papers, he said, "This is very irregular, All the way to India and no luggage. Shaking his head, he turned away. The former clerk apparently had decided to wash his hands of the whole affair, for he turned away and would not answer when I asked the location of the ship. Finally, I looked at the new papers in my hand and saw that one was a boarding card giving all the required details. It was a long walk to the ship's side, and when I reached it, I saw policemen lounging about but carefully watching passengers. I walked forward, showed my ticket, and walked up the gangplank. An hour or so later, two men came to my cabin and asked why I had no luggage. "But my dear man," I said, "I thought this was the land of the free? Why should I be encumbered with luggage? What I take is my own affair, surely?" He muttered and mumbled, and fiddled with papers and said, "Well, we have to make sure that everything is all right. The clerk thought you were trying to escape from justice as you had no luggage. He was only trying to make sure." I pointed to my case. "All I need is there, it will get me to India. In India I can pick up other luggage." He looked relieved. "Ah. So you have other luggage, in India? Then that is all right." I smiled to myself as I thought, the only time I have trouble in entering or leaving a country is when I do it legally, when I have all the papers red tape demands. Life aboard the ship was dull. The other passengers were very class conscious, and the story that I had brought only one case apparently put me outside the range of human society. Because I did not conform to the snobbish norm, I was as lonely as if I had been in a prison cell, but with the great difference that I could move about. It was amusing to see other passengers call a steward to have their deck chairs moved a little further away from me. We sailed from the port of New York to the Straits of Gibraltar. Across the Mediterranean Sea we steamed, calling at Alexandria, and then going on to Port Said, steaming along the Suez Canal to enter the Red Sea. The heat affected me badly. The Red Sea was almost steaming, but at last it came to an end, and we crossed the Arabian Sea to finally dock at Bombay. I had a few friends in that city, Buddhist priests and others, and I spent a week in their company before continuing my journey across India to Kalimpong. Kalimpong was full of communist spies and newspaper men. New arrivals found their life was made a misery by the endless, senseless questioning, questions which I never answered but continued what I was doing. This penchant of Western people to pry into the affairs of others was a complete mystery to me. I really did not understand it. I was glad to get out of Kalimpong and move into my own country, Tibet. I had been expected, and was met by a party of high lamas disguised as mendicant monks and traders. My health was deteriorating rapidly, and necessitated frequent stops and rest. At long last, some 10 weeks later, we reached a secluded lamasery high in the Himalayas, overlooking the valley of Lhasa, a lamasery so small and so inaccessible that Chinese communists would not bother about it. For some days I rested, trying to regain a little of my strength, rested, and meditated. I was home now, and happy for the first time in years. The deceptions and treachery of Western peoples seemed to be no more than an evil nightmare. Daily, little groups of men came to me, to tell me of events in Tibet, and to listen to me while I told them of the strange harsh world outside our frontiers. I attended all the services, finding comfort and solace in the familiar rituals. Yet I was a man apart, a man who was about to die and live again. A man who was about to undergo one of the strangest experiences to fall to the lot of a living creature. Yet was it so strange? Many of our higher adepts did it for life after life. The Dalai Lama himself did it, time after time taking over the body of a newborn baby. But the difference was, I was going to take over the body of an adult, and mold his body to mine, changing molecule by molecule the complete body, not just the ego. Although not a Christian, my studies at Lhasa had required me to read the Christian Bible and listen to lectures on it. I knew that in the Bible it was stated that the body of Jesus, the son of Mary and Joseph, was taken over by the Spirit of the Son of God and became Christ. I knew too that the Christian priests had had a convention in the year 60 AD, to ban certain teachings of Christ. Reincarnation was banned, the taking over of the body of others was banned, together with many, many matters taught by Christ. I looked out of my glassless window at the city of Lhasa so far below. It was hard to realize that the hated communists were in charge there. So far they were trying to win over the young Tibetans by wonderful promises. We called it the honey on the knife. The more one licked the honey, the sooner was the sharp blade revealed. Chinese troops stood on guard at the Pagokling. Chinese troops stood at the entrances to our temples, like pickets at a Western world strike, stood jeering at our ancient religion. Monks were being insulted, even manhandled, and the illiterate peasants and herdsmen were encouraged to do likewise. Here we were safe from the communists, safe in this almost unclimbable precipice. About us the whole area was honeycombed with caves, and there was but one precipitous path winding round the very edge of the cliffs, with a sheer drop of more than 2,000 feet for those who slipped. Here, when venturing out in the open, we used grey robes which blended with the rock face. Grey robes which concealed us from the chance gaze of the Chinese using binoculars. Far off I could see Chinese specialists with theodolites and measuring sticks. They crawled about like ants, placing pegs into the ground, making entries in their books. A monk crossed in front of a soldier. The Chinese jabbed at the monk's leg with his bayonet. Through the 20 magnification binoculars, my one luxury, which I had brought, I could see the spurt of blood and the sadistic grin on the face of the Chinese. These glasses were good, revealing the proud Potala and my own Chakporai. Something nagged at the back of my mind. Something was missing. I refocused the binoculars and looked again. Upon the waters of the Serpent Temple Lake nothing stirred. In the streets of Lhasa no dogs nuzzled among refuse piles. No wildfowl, no dogs. I turned to the monk at my side. The communists had them all killed for food. Dogs do not work, therefore they shall not eat, said the communists, but they shall do one service in providing food. It is now an offense to have a dog or a cat or a pet of any kind. I looked in horror at the monk. An offense to keep a pet. Instinctively I looked again at the Chakporai. What happened to our cats there? I asked. Killed and eaten, was the reply. I sighed and thought, oh. If I could tell people the truth about communism, how they really treat people. If only the Westerners were not so squeamish. I thought of the community of nuns of whom I had heard so recently from a High Lama who, upon his journey, had come across a lone survivor and heard her story before she died in his arms. Her community of nuns, she told him, had been invaded by a wild band of Chinese soldiers. They had desecrated the sacred objects and stolen all that there was of value. The aged superior, they had stripped and rubbed her with butter. Then they had set her alight and laughed and shouted with joy at her screams. At last her poor blackened body lay still upon the ground, and a soldier drew his bayonet the length of her body to make sure that she was dead. Old nuns were stripped and had red-hot irons thrust into them so that they died in agony. Younger nuns were raped in front of each other, each being raped some 20 or 30 times during the 3 days that the soldiers stayed. Then they tired of the sport, or were exhausted, for they turned upon the women in a last frenzy of savagery. Some women had parts cut off, some were slit open. Yet others were driven, still naked, out into the bitter cold. A little party of monks who were traveling to Lhasa had come upon them and had tried to help them, giving the women their own robes, trying to keep the feeble light of life flickering. The Chinese communist soldiers, also on the way to Lhasa, had come upon them and had treated the monks with such savage brutality that such things could not be put into print. The monks, mutilated beyond hope of saving, had been turned loose, naked, bleeding, until they died from loss of blood. One woman alone had survived. She had fallen in a ditch and had been hidden by prayer flags which the Chinese had ripped from their posts. At long last, the Lama and his attendant acolyte had come upon the gruesome scene and together had heard the full tale from the nun's dying lips. Oh! To tell the Western world of the terrors of communism, I thought, but as I was later to find, to my cost, one cannot write or talk of the truth in the West. All horrors must be smoothed over. All must have a patina of decency. Are the communists decent when they rape, mutilate, and kill? If the people of the West would listen to the true accounts of those who have suffered, they would indeed save themselves such horrors, for communism is insidious, like cancer, and while people are prepared to think that this dreadful cult is merely different politics, then there is danger indeed for the peoples of the world. As one who has suffered, I would say, show people in print and pictures, no matter how dreadful, what goes on behind these iron curtains. While I was ruminating upon these things, and spasmodically scanning the landscape before me, an aged man, bent and walking with a stick, entered my room. His face was lined with much suffering, and his bones stood out prominently, covered only by parchment-tight, withered skin. I saw that he was sightless and I rose to take his arm. His eye sockets glared as angry red holes, and his movements were uncertain, as are those of the recently blinded. I sat him by me, and gently held his hand, thinking that here in this invaded land we had nothing now with which to alleviate his suffering and ease the pain of those inflamed sockets. He smiled patiently and said, "You are wondering about my eyes, brother. I was upon the holy way, making my prostrations at a shrine. As I rose to my feet I gazed upon the Potala, and by a mischance a Chinese officer was in my line of sight. He charged that I was gazing upon him arrogantly, that I was looking at him offensively. I was tied by a rope to the end of his car and dragged along the ground to the square. Their spectators were rounded up, and in front of them my eyes were gouged out and thrown at me. My body, as you can surely see, has many half-healed wounds. I was brought here by others and now I am glad to greet you." I gasped with horror as he pulled open his robe, for his body was a raw red mass through being dragged along the road. I well knew this man. Under him, as an acolyte, I had studied things of the mind. I had known him when I became a lama, for he had been one of my sponsors. He had been one of the lamas when I had journeyed far down beneath the Potala to endure the ceremony of the little death. Now he sat beside me, and I knew that his death was not far off. "You have traveled far and have seen and endured much," he said. "Now my last task in this incarnation is to help you obtain glimpses, through the Akashic record, of the life of a certain Englishman who is most anxious to depart his body that you may take over. You will have glimpses only, for it takes much energy and we are both low in strength." He paused, and then, with a faint smile on his face, continued, "The effort will finish this present life of mine, and I am glad to have this opportunity of acquiring merit through this last task. Thank you, brother, for making it possible. When you return here from the astral journey, I shall be dead beside you." The Akashic record. What a wonderful source of knowledge that was. What a tragedy that people did not investigate its possibilities instead of meddling with atom bombs. Everything we do, everything that happens, is indelibly impressed upon the Akasha, that subtle medium which interpenetrates all matter. Every movement which has taken place on Earth since Earth first was, is available for those with the necessary training. To those with their eyes open, the history of the world lies before them. An old prediction says that after the end of this century scientists will be able to use the Akashic record to look into history. It would be interesting to know what Cleopatra really said to Antony, and what Mr. Gladstone's famous remarks were. To me it would be delightful to see my critics' faces when they saw what asses they really are, when they had to admit that I wrote the truth after all. But, sad to say, none of us will be here then. But this Akashic record, can we explain it more clearly? Everything that happens impresses itself upon that medium which interpenetrates even air. Once a sound has been made, or an action initiated, it is there for all time. With suitable instruments anyone could see it. Look at it in terms of light, or the vibrations which we call light and sight. Light travels at a certain speed. As every scientist knows, we see stars at night which may no longer be in existence. Some of those stars are so very far away that the light from them which is now reaching us may have started on its journey before this Earth came into being. We have no way of knowing if the star died a million or so years ago because the light would still reach us for perhaps a million more years. It might be easier to remind one of sound. We see the flash of lightning and hear the sound sometime later. It is the slowness of sound which makes for the delay in hearing it after seeing the flash. It is the slowness of light which may make possible an instrument for seeing the past.